Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. I'm Marcia Mary Baker, and today is Saturday, October 17, 2009, and our topic for discussion for the next hour is General McChrystal's Folly. Now, this refers to the title of a paper written recently by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. Of course, it's referring to Afghanistan and the drumbeat for the United States to go along this route of getting yet further completely involved in an insane kind of British imperial policy in this region of the world. And the individuals that we have to discuss this today, our guests, I welcome here live in the studio, Jeff Steinberg. Welcome.
Hi, Marcia. How are you?
Good. And Jeff, of course, is known by many things, but he's our counterintelligence editor and our Asia, especially subcontinent EIR desk, Ramtanu Maitra. Welcome, Tanu. Hi.
Thanks, Marcia. Pleasure to be here.
And this, I mentioned the focus about this insane policy that's being pursued, that the United States should have, some people call it another Vietnam, but actually the world is different. It is much worse today. Let me refer to the context of our discussion. In fact, what we have is the crash is on. You could call it the October crash, just referring to how Mr. LaRouche in recent weeks and months, in fact, pointed out that there are phase shifts, not just chronologies underway, and we are seeing a physical economic downshift. We don't just have financial chaos, we have real disintegration of conditions, physical conditions of life. So in the midst of that, it's critical for us to discuss strategic realities, not any one issue, not any one campaign, and that's where this matter of the strategic reality of what's involved in inducing the United States on these terrible foreign policy paths that we see in the way of the Afghanistan question, that this really has to be faced and it has to be stopped. Now, I want to point out one thing. Mr. Lyndon LaRouche and his wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, were recently in an international policy dialogue. This was last weekend. I think it was the 9th and 10th of October in the Isle of Rhodes. And Mr. LaRouche has been in Europe meeting with people. And in terms of policy, he himself will give an international webcast November 11th. Keep that in mind. You know it's on LaRouche Political Action Committee's website, LaRouchePAC.com. And before that, Helga Zepp LaRouche will also give a webcast based out of Europe October 29th. So we'll have more on that as we go along. But as we began the program, what our top focus is today is that there is a drumbeat for an increased U.S. troop presence by the thousands, NATO troop presence in Afghanistan, and for an extended period of time. But this whole thing is the kind of continuation of great game politics that you don't want at all. You certainly don't want it continued. You want it canceled. So with that in mind, Jeff, maybe you just want to open up the discussion about what we're saying when Mr. LaRouche says General Stanley Crystal's folly is what we have to face.
Well, I think it's important to go back to March of this year when the administration supposedly completed a strategic review of the U.S. policy on Afghanistan. Of course, as a presidential candidate, Obama had made the terrible mistake of saying that while he was critical of the invasion of Iraq, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the process of getting bogged down in a war in Iraq for 5 years, he defined Afghanistan as a war of necessity. So he had already kind of put his foot in his mouth in a bad way during the campaign. And supposedly this strategic review in March was going to devise some kind of a policy way forward. Unfortunately, it did no such thing. The review, which some people may remember, was presented with a great big ego drum roll as the first serious reconsideration of the Afghan war policy in a long time after the Bush administration dropped the ball and got fixated on Iraq, really didn't present anything new. There was no consideration of how to deal with the fact that the Karzai government was terribly corrupt, that you had a completely out-of-control narco-economy building up, 95% of the world's opium and heroin supply coming out of Afghanistan. And there was no decision made on any of the issues that had to be addressed before you could even take up the question of how do you deal with the military aspects of the situation. So not surprisingly, a number of months later, after Obama had fired the previous U.S. and NATO commander, General McKiernan, and replaced him with General McChrystal, they started all over again and ordered McChrystal to do a review and to come up with a commander's set of recommendations. The outcome was a foregone conclusion. Someone made a comment the other day that if you've got a landscaping problem and you go to a gardener and ask him to come up with solutions, he's going to say you're going to have to reseed and plant a whole new garden, and he'll give you an estimate of what it would cost to do it. If you went to a cement mason with the same problem, he'd tell you to dig up the garden and put in a cement patio. So the mere fact that they put McChrystal in the position of coming up with a military strategy while they were waiting on the outcome of the elections before deciding on what would be possible from a political or economic standpoint, what could be done in terms of regional stability, it was a guaranteed recipe for disaster. And of course, McChrystal walked right into it by simply coming back and saying, we know the number, 80,000 more troops immediately in 2010. We don't even come close to having 80,000 troops available in the rotation. We've still got 140,000 or so in Iraq, presumably starting to come home, and that won't be completed until the end of 2011. So the whole thing was a great big lesson in incompetence. And McChrystal compounded things by concluding that he was expected to be the international sales representative for this expansion and change to a full-blown Vietnam-style counterinsurgency war. And so he went off to London and gave a public speech, a very highly publicized speech, at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and basically said that there is no alternative to his plan for a gigantic troop expansion and a shift from counterterror to full-blown hearts and minds counterinsurgency operations like Vietnam in the mountains. And so it finally reached a point of embarrassment that this thing was really handled like amateur hour, that the president was dispatched to Copenhagen. He was on his way back from that whole Olympic fiasco that we won't even talk about. But he was essentially ordered that he had to discipline McChrystal and told him to keep his mouth shut. But in the meantime, if there's a silver lining in this whole catastrophic fiasco, it's that now, very belatedly, there is actually some kind of policy deliberation being forced, and there are at least two alternatives to the McChrystal folly that are on the table. And a lot of this is kind of out there in the news, so I can summarize it really quickly. Vice President Biden is basically saying that the McChrystal plan should be flat out rejected, that we should greatly narrow the mission to a limited counterterror mission targeting primarily al-Qaeda and also targeting in a more limited way the Taliban. And he's talking about a plan that could result in an immediate drawdown of American troops and preparation for an exit strategy. He's been also emphasizing more focus on Pakistan than Afghanistan. And then you've got a kind of a middle ground, far less than what McChrystal is demanding, but a kind of a healthy center involving Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Defense Gates, and National Security Advisor General Jones, who are insisting that a strategy has to be devised first before any decision can be made on military deployment. And they're adamant against a big troop buildup as per what's been requested by McChrystal. So they're going to take another week or so to bat these things around. It's probably a very valuable educational process for the president, who, as we know, doesn't know much about anything, to be sitting around and participating in discussion among some adults who, whether you agree with their positions or not, are actually trying to come up with some way out of a mess that's been going on for 8 years and gets worse by the hour. So I think that's pretty much where things stand in terms of the administration deliberations. And I would just caution people that 99% of what's coming out in the media is total rubbish and propaganda, and is probably more than anything aimed at trying to force a fait accompli on the president and his national security advisors to try to jam them to force a decision. And the people most actively trying to do that are in the McChrystal camp.
Right. Well, there are many things to draw out from what you said. One thing is the pedigree of continuing this kind of presence anyway since 2001.
Right.
That's actually creating chaos in the region. Maybe, Tana, you want to address that, as opposed to, I think Mr. LaRouche just said a few hours ago, Jeff, you were meeting with him and staff, and LaRouche was stressing what you want to really try and do is just solve problems, not once and for all, but contribute to order and peace in the greater region at large,
right,
instead of this.
Yeah, this is, I think, that what is missing in all these deliberations, I mean, going back to President Obama's March announcement of the Afghan policy, the nowhere it has been defined very clearly that when we plan to withdraw from that place, whether we do have a plan to withdraw from that place, the two major problems that we have created over this 8 years of stay, which is that, you know, 44,000 tons of opium has been produced during these 8 years, which is about 20,000 more than what the world consumes. And this opium has been converted into heroin. And in addition to that, there is marijuana, hashish, and all that. Now, where is in this Afghan policy that we are trying to resolve killing Taliban or killing Al-Qaeda? How you deal with this thing? Because this has definitely has created a very serious problem in Iran, which is next door. And then as far up north as Russia, which is a very important nation, and a nation like that should not be undermined by opium and heroin. But it has been done. Nowhere it has been addressed by the president or by president's advisors that how to stop this degeneration of the region caused by these 8 years of war and continuing war. The second thing is that there are, you know, many reasons why Pakistan is involved in this warfare. But the process has also degenerated Pakistan's situation in a very big way. And one must remember that Pakistan perhaps still has the best army in among the Islamic nations. And whenever the Islamic nations in the Middle East get into problem, they bring in Pakistan army for protection and security. Now, the process itself, process may have started years before, but really during these 8 years, Pakistan army has taken a very heavy beating. Pakistan as a country has taken enormous amount of beating, and the economic condition of Pakistan has gone down steeply. But all these things, we are not talking about a nation of, you know, 15 million people or 20 million. This is a 150 million people nation, and which is, you know, bordering not only the Muslim nations, but also Central Asia, and also China and also India. So all the effects of these things, you know, this regional instability is spreading like a spoke on all directions. And we have no way of controlling this thing. There is nothing in our Afghan policy which addresses that these issues, the much bigger harm has been done, and this bigger harm can get the whole region into much bigger trouble, and we must take measures through deliberations with these regional powers and regional nations to stop the rot that has, you know, that has begun. So that's I think is one of the very major shortcomings in the deliberations that are taking place at this time.
Right, and with your mention of the increased opium production, some of the figures show that maybe before, in the early 90s, there might have been 2,000 tons, but then it went up to 4,000, 7,000, 8,000 tons a year.
Right.
So the trend is clear. And before we get into some of the pedigree of who's running this, it obviously is in the immediate region and internationally, and we're talking about, this brings us back to the British imperial circles, but the world dope trade. But on agriculture, during the same time, you have a tremendous degradation of an already tricky system for, what is it, 34 million people in Afghanistan?
Yes, 35. Mm-hmm.
But you had some system in the past that functioned.
Yes, I think that the agricultural the difficulties that the Afghans face today, it cannot be fully attributed to this 8 years of war. I think the 30 years of war that they're going through, that began with 1979, with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the huge bombing, then the mining and all this kind of thing that was done, it basically destroyed the Helmand River Valley, which is a huge wheat production area in the south. Was completely being all these. One should go back and look in the 1950s when U.S. was building all this. Most of the Helmand River dams and the barrages for agricultural purposes were built by the Americans. And at one point in time, which is sounds kind of funny now, because the capital of Helmand, which is also the capital of opium probably, is known as Lashkar Gah. The Gah means fort. And Lashkar means soldiers. So it's a fort for the soldiers. But the Lashkar Gah was once upon a time in 1950s. It was projected. I have gone through articles where it says the New York, going to be New York of Afghanistan. That's what the Americans were saying. That it will be the most, most dazzling city in the middle of desert and all that kind of, all that is gone. The bombing, the mining, the incessant war for 30 years, civil war, then the foreign troops, and then Taliban and everything that Afghanistan has gone through so far, has destroyed everything. All the infrastructure are gone, excepting the ring road, which is goes around Afghanistan, and which is good thing, but in the present context is also the bad thing because that brings all the opium and heroin all over.
Yeah, let me actually jump in because I think that what Tano just went through sort of gets to a very fundamental thing here. Which is that we're talking about a 30 years war and we're talking about an opium war. And these are two hallmarks of the British Empire. And the British have historically looked at this whole area as an area of their colonial sphere of influence. And I think it's important to remember that we have two situations globally which stand out above all others as the kind of running sores that just become more and more entrenched and more difficult to conceive of a way out of. One is this whole situation in South Asia, and the other is the Arab-Israeli conflict in the Middle East. And in both cases, you had areas where you had British imperial control, British mandate in the case of Palestine. And when the British at the end of World War II were forced to face a regroupment moment where they could no longer maintain their colonial empire in the previous form, in both South Asia and in the Middle East. What they did on their way out the door was set up partitions that were aimed at creating permanent conflict. And in fact, some of the Americans who I've spoken with, senior retired military people, some of the people directly involved in this belated, serious attempt to do a policy review, have said that you have to look at the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan from the standpoint that there are two overlapping and simultaneous wars going on. You have an American-commanded NATO war, coalition war, against Al-Qaeda and Taliban. And then you've got elements of the continuing India-Pakistan conflict, which overlays on this situation. And if you don't take that into account, as well as the conventional way it's presented as NATO versus the terrorists, you really miss the boat, because Pakistan, especially the Pakistani military, looks at Afghanistan as their strategic depth. India has been heavily involved historically in the backing of the Northern Alliance against the Taliban. Throughout much of the 1990s, you had that phase of the civil war in Afghanistan, in which you had really a surrogate war between India backing the Northern Alliance, Pakistani ISI backing Taliban. And there are elements of the current situation, particularly with the dilemma of how to deal with the Karzai government and what kind of new government is going to occur once the whole electoral mess gets sorted out. You've got this other dimension, and in a certain sense, just as the Middle East is plagued by the legacy and the continuation of the Sykes-Picot imperial divisions of that region, you've got a similar process in South Asia. And Tanu, I mean, you've written about this in great depth, and your articles from EIR are being picked up all over the place as kind of, you know, a food for thought for people within the region coming to grips with this. I don't, you want to say something more on what I just went through?
Yes, I think that I just want to add one more thing, is that when the British left, the British Raj left Indian subcontinent, they broke it up into two, but the kind of mindset that they, the elite that they created, because they were there for 150 years, almost 200 years, and you know, entire elite of India, Pakistan, and which just turned out to be Bangladesh, the third nation, and around it were developed by the British. And when they left, there were two nations. Then the mindset that they created would not allow the conflicts that they left behind to be resolved. So one of the hallmark of the British empire is that, and this is the way you build your empire with a small number of people, is that you always create conflicts between adjacent groups. And this is often being called as divide and rule policy. But when you are brought up with that ideology, with that education, that that the only system that you are aware of, but you are now heading an independent nation, as it happened in Africa all over. So Africa broke up into small little nations and hundreds of nations. In India, Pakistan, the similar kind of thing exists, that they do not know how to resolve the conflicts, because the British Empire never resolves any conflict. They create conflicts. It is through the creation of conflict, they get hold of the landmass and for looting and, you know, tax collection, and that was the basic fundamental of the empire building. So when the British left and the Indians and Pakistanis, they just festered the conflicts that existed, and eventually it now broken up into three nations. Now Bangladesh has been created, because Pakistan couldn't resolve its own conflict with the eastern wing, and it resulted. So, and also the similar kind of thing is developing in Pakistan. Pakistan's western part, which is the tribal area and Balochistan, have not been taken care of. They have not done any development. So it has become criminalized, drugs, smuggling, etc., all the other things. The criminalization has alienated the population of that area from the mainstream Pakistanis. And Pakistan, you know, they couldn't resolve that conflict. Then they come to Jammu and Kashmir. Now, Jammu and Kashmir is not only India-Pakistan, but it borders China as well. And they couldn't resolve this one. And this mindset that the British had created is a very important thing. Now, one other thing that I want to add to what Jeff was addressing on the Afghanistan thing is that Afghanistan doesn't have oil, doesn't have gas, doesn't have anything. But Afghanistan is kind of a buffer between, if you go south of Afghanistan, you will find oil, gas all over. If you go west of it, you will find oil, gas. If you go north of it, so British considered that this area is not important for anybody. But for the empire, it's a very important area. From here, you operate, you control Central Asia, you control Middle East, you control west of Afghanistan. There's Azerbaijan and all that in other areas. So for the British, Afghanistan is extremely important, but Afghanistan cannot generate any cash. Only cash it can generate is out of opium. So when they came into here, now this is the first time they had a long stay, an 8-year stay. Other times they got kicked out. They used the opium to fund the war to a large extent. And one other thing that must be pointed out is that now that the global financial system has collapsed, one thing that has not collapsed is this criminal source of money generation. This money is very real, and this is something of the order of $400 to $500 billion from the street value. And this is going into the criminal elements, going into the offshore banking, going into City of London, coming into Wall Street. And this is how many of these are, quote-unquote, respectable banks are surviving.
Right. Well, do you want to say anything more, Jeff, on the pedigree of this? I mean, this goes back. You're describing this specific world-class opium-producing center. But this gets us into the international dope ink. I mean, you can go back 100 years to the, 100 and more years to the China dope trade and so forth. But also allied with networks very active in this, you've exposed some of the British-Saudi collaboration to keep this all going.
Well, yeah, let me say a few things about it. And then, again, I think Tano should pick up on this because he's written some really extraordinarily important and very in-depth articles on this. But just to set the larger framework, I mean, it's broadly known that going all the way back to the 1970s, when King Fahd was the monarch of Saudi Arabia, that he began a program of funding the exporting of Wahhabi fundamentalism. And South Asia was a very, very important target of this. There's an earlier history of this kind of spread of fundamentalist Islam into that part of the world. But I would say that the modern period began in the mid-70s when King Fahd sort of went on the offensive against communism, particularly when Jimmy Carter was elected president of the United States. It was no secret that the Saudis thought that the U.S. would wimp out on the Cold War. And so undoubtedly with an enormous amount of British prodding, they began building up massive numbers of madrasas, schools, and began spreading fundamentalism throughout this whole area. At the same time, there was a strategic deployment to the United States of a senior British intelligence official named Dr. Bernard Lewis, who came out of the old Arab Bureau and who came to Princeton University, became an advisor first to Kissinger and then much more actively involved as an advisor to the Carter administration. And he promoted the idea that the West should encourage the spread of Islamic fundamentalism across the southern tier of the Soviet Union. They called this the Crescent of Crisis. And so with heavy Saudi involvement, with the British prodding Brzezinski and others who were profiled as being obsessively anti-Russian, anti-Soviet, they spread the idea that Islamic fundamentalism was a powerful weapon to be used against the Soviet Union because godless communism is the enemy of Islamic fundamentalism. And so what you had was this alliance between the Saudi and British monarchies to promote fundamentalism. And by the mid-1980s, we'd already seen the Islamic Revolution in Iran, other developments, the simultaneous beginning of pretty massive Anglo-American, French, Israeli funding with the Saudis of the recruitment of what came to be known as the Afghan Mujahideen Freedom Fighters. They were being recruited even before the Soviet Red Army invaded Afghanistan Christmas Eve of 1979. So in other words, with a major role by the Saudis, a major role by the British, and a major amount of stupidity on the part of the United States, the Carter administration, we were off and running, and this was picked up with even greater enthusiasm during the Reagan period. I remember being up on Capitol Hill and seeing people who would later reincarnate as the neoconservatives during the George W. Bush period being the tour guides for the people that we're now denouncing as Taliban or as, you know, right, narco lords, opium lords, touring them around Capitol Hill as freedom fighters, the identical people. People used to praise Osama bin Laden as the Tom Marriott of Peshawar. He ran a hospitality operation for the incoming Mujahideen fighters recruited from the Arab world and North Africa. They basically emptied out their jails and sent people in to fight in Afghanistan. But in 1985, a much more durable deal was struck between Saudi Arabia and Britain, which was a ostensibly an arms-for-oil deal called Al-Yamama. But our own EIR unique investigation to this has shown that what actually happened is that, yes, there was military equipment manufactured by the Brits, sold to the Saudi Air Force. Yes, there were shipments of oil that were used to pay for this. But within this transaction, enormous amounts of oil were basically sold on the spot market at tremendous markup, and those funds were set aside into an offshore Anglo-Saudi covert slush fund for conducting clandestine intelligence operations. At the time, it was all vectored against the Soviet Union. It was kind of a continuation of King Fahd's jihad against godless communism. But now you had a mechanism where hundreds of billions of dollars was sloshing around available to provide weapons for the Mujahideen, to do all kinds of things. These funds continue to exist. The Al-Yamama program, under which this was launched, still exists to this day, hundreds of billions of dollars later. So you actually have a structure of this Anglo-Saudi cooperation. And unfortunately, successive U.S. governments have liked the idea of being in on the game and, you know, having access to these funds for various purposes. So, I mean, that's one aspect of understanding how this South Asia crisis is a product of other elements of this Anglo-Saudi cooperation. Clearly, intellectually, the British were driving this thing, and the Saudis were the piggy bank, and they had this kind of uneasy coexistence between Aramco and the Wahhabi religious police that kind of still defines the tension points inside Saudi culture today. But Tanya, you may want to say.
Yeah, I want to add one other thing. I want to throw it into the discussion. Is this now Britain had long been exploiting Iran and had been long been in trouble with Iran going back to the Anglo-Iranian oil days, and Mossadegh time and all that. Systematically, Iran had come to understand that Britain is one of the worst enemy to their nation, and they have said it, and Mossadegh has said it, and very clearly, in an interview when in this Iranian oil privatization was coming up in 1953, President Truman sent Averell Harriman to Mossadegh he was the prime minister at the time, to cool him down, and this was reported by Vernon Walters, he's long gone. He was aide to Averell Harriman at the time, and he was in the meeting, and in which Mossadegh said, was telling Averell Harriman, "You do not know them; they are evil, and they whatever they touch, they sully it." And Harriman, he himself was a bit of an Anglophile, no question about it, and he thought that Mossadegh was accusing all the British, all the Britons, as evil. And he sort of said, Britons are, they are good people, they are bad people, like in other, among others. And Mossadegh was not paying any attention to them because he was not addressing an individual Briton, he was talking about British Empire. Now, Saudis, who preach the most orthodox medieval variety of Islam, which is called Wahhabism, to them, Iranian Shia is as much of an enemy as a Hindu or a Christian or a Jew. So one of the things that the British picked up that in order to fight Iran, in order to keep Iran down under its thumb, it must use Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia was used in this particular case after the Soviets were defeated and Afghanistan fell into a civil war. At that point in time, there was no hope for anybody coming to power in Kabul. And it is the British-Saudi plan said, let's create something that no Afghan Mujahideen leader can fight, which is Islamic flag. So put up the Islamic flag and create Taliban. Taliban was created in 1994, around that time, 1994-95. And they put up the Islamic flag. All the Mujahideen leaders who are fighting with each other before couldn't fight anymore. And the Pakistanis, at the same time, they sucked the Pakistanis in because Pakistanis saw that if we have a virulently anti-Hindu, anti-Christian, anti-everything, anti-Shia, anti-Jew government in Afghanistan, there will be very anti-India as well. So, from Pakistan's point of view, in order to develop its strategic depth and in order to make that a solid, bastion, they supported this thing. They had nothing anti-Iran per se. They had nothing else. They had no intent other than using Afghanistan as a strategic depth. Only way British could come into Afghanistan at that point in time, have any influence at that point in time, is riding on the shoulder of Saudi Arabia. The necessity is to have control over Central Asia, keep Iran down, and have control over Middle East oil. And so this was the way this Saudi-British thing is working for quite a long time. And one of the things that Jeff pointed out is one thing that we exposed, the corruption and all that is involved in all this, and the money monetary stuff. But the British-Saudi stuff, you have to remember that during T.H. Lawrence of Arabia, and they brought in from the Bedouins from Saudi Arabia to rule Iraq, because Iraq is one of the most civilized Islamic state. And then in Syria, which is the other most civilized, Syria and Lebanon at the time. So they put two Bedouins in the most two civilized countries, and in order to destroy or control and destroy the Islamic culture. So, the British game in this is, is a very, very old and very, very has a long route. And if you don't understand that, then you will never be able to fight it.
Right, and maybe this is only a footnote, but and you can comment on it or not, but then if you go back to cover the sweep you two have been talking about since the Second World War, on the physical economic side then, any development you might have had was suppressed in the course of it. If you take Egypt, for example, mm-hmm. where you had a development decade with the building of the Aswan Dam with other intentions, but all of this was beaten back and suppressed, and so you had an actual degradation of what could have been development in the region.
Right. I you want to address this, Jeff?
Why don't you take this, because I wanted to get back before we end and take a look at some interesting things that are going on the Pakistan side right. now that may prove to be a miscalculation on the part of the British.
Mm-hmm. This is a bit general, but the fact of the matter is that Egypt, as you mentioned, Egypt and the Aswan Dam and all that, Egypt did have a well-established leader like Jamal Abdel Nasser. But at that time, our main enemy was the Soviet Union, and anybody who is has any shade of red or anybody has any connection with Soviet Union is being immediately attacked as a socialist and a potential communist. But Nasser was also a nation builder of a type. I'm not saying that he's the greatest nation builder, but he was a nation builder. Saddam Hussein in many ways was like the same way too, and we fought a war against Saddam Hussein, more than war probably too. But when this Nasser and all these people were dismantled because were forced to leave because they had their socialist connections, and in a country like Iraq or a country like Egypt, when you remove these things, then it's like a big tree falls in a forest, and then you move in with your Muslim fundamentalist, Muslim Brotherhood, and all this kind of thing in order to gain control of the place. And that's what I personally think, that whatever the Muslim Brotherhood, the rise of Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, what Iraq will undergo in the coming years, hopefully not, but there's a strong possibility, will be again, it is the British-run Muslim Brotherhood. And which could be of Shia variety, which could be of Sunni variety, but the fact of the matter is, to bring these countries, put these countries back again, in the not from developing itself and taking leadership of the area.
All right. Well, you want to say something about Pakistan, Jeff, and also before the hour is out, just the opposite approach, or the higher level, it isn't even on the same plane, of Mr. LaRouche talking about four leading powers in right. the world leading the way out of this British divide, conquer, and ruin, but on Pakistan.
Yeah, I think it's also important to underscore that the British make mistakes. They miscalculate, and very often the miscalculation comes up when you get some effort on the part of leading circles in the United States to sort things out and figure out how to get out of a mess. I mean, we're in a total mess in South Asia, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel whatsoever. There's the Afghanistan situation, which suffers from the fact that there's really no credible government at this point. We're waiting to hear today whether they're going to actually insist on a second round of elections. The first round was so tarnished by fraud that they're now saying that President Karzai did not get the 50% plus one vote needed to avoid a runoff. But in Pakistan, there's been an attempt on the part of some of the people in the Obama administration, not necessarily with any great input from the president himself, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, is in constant contact with the head of the Pakistani military, General Kayani, and with the head of the ISI, the intelligence service, the military intelligence service, General Pasha. And we've been providing a certain amount of assistance. We've been trying to make sure that the very weak President Zardari, the widow of Benazir Bhutto, is able to hold on to power. We're trying to do some things to help them out economically. And right now, we're at a very, I think, telling moment. Historically, the ISI has supported these various fundamentalist groups. Really, Taliban, as Tana was saying a few minutes ago, is kind of the new kids on the block. They only existed since the mid-1990s. But you have other groups like Lashkar, which was involved in the Mumbai attacks, and a number of other organizations that have a much longer history, much deeper roots, ties to London, ties to Saudi Arabia through financing. And those groups, I think, have made a significant tactical mistake. In the last 2 weeks, you've had a whole series of car bombings, suicide bombings, many of them either targeting civilian populations or targeting military facilities themselves. And so you've got a situation now where Taliban inside Pakistan is a different phenomenon than Taliban next door in Afghanistan, making sure that the Pakistanis have strategic depth and that they don't have a kind of a quasi-surrogate Indian government in power in Kabul. But the embarrassment to the military of these recent attacks, I think, may represent a phase shift. That's what I'm hearing from some people in Washington just in the last 24 hours, that the Pakistani army is building up between 50 and 75,000 troops, and as of today is moving into one of these tribal area strongholds in Waziristan. And it looks to be the most serious actual attempt to break the back of these people, whereas always before, there's been a little bit of military action and then a ceasefire negotiated where the net effect is the safe haven under the protection of the Pakistani military has been maintained. What I'm hearing from people in Washington is that with a lot of encouragement from the United States, that the Pakistanis are now dead serious about moving in and wiping out this fundamentalist infrastructure, including those elements of Taliban and Al-Qaeda that everyone knows are in Pakistan and not even in Afghanistan right now, including Mullah Omar. And whether bin Laden and Zawahiri are still alive, they're in that Pakistan area if they are alive. So the prospect now is that you could see a significant blow delivered to this Anglo-Saudi-sponsored fundamentalist apparatus if this military operation is successful, and we're not going to know that for months probably, but if it proceeds seriously and it is successful, then it creates a very different situation in Afghanistan as well and opens up the possibility of some kind of stabilization and the ability to develop a solution that has a political, economic, and security dimension. If the U.S. negotiations as part of the P5 plus one successfully goes forward with Iran, that's another big plus. If the Hillary Clinton, Sergei Lavrov commission of U.S.-Russian cooperation gets some real traction, that's a very big plus. You could potentially have key elements of a regional alliance where the real interest for stability is there. If you think of this as a NATO mission, you get into all the complications of the Brits, the Scandinavians, the Dutch. You know, there's a very strong appetite in a number of these European countries for the dope money coming out of the opium and heroin sales out of Afghanistan. They run Dubai as their sort of latter-day equivalent of what Hong Kong was during the 19th century opium wars. And so if you can get cooperation among the regional powers with the United States, get Russia and China in on that because they've got strong vested interests in that. And if the Pakistanis are encouraged and are successful in cracking down on this apparatus on the Pakistani side of the border, then you can start to see the shape of an exit strategy for the United States from Afghanistan, and no big U.S. troop buildup, but the development of a regional strategy that has stability, economic development, cooperation among neighbors at the core of it. And it starts getting at some of the underlying British games in pitting India against Pakistan, which is the thing that's got to be solved for this thing to ever be stabilized. So that's my...
Yeah, I think that I'm fully confident that Pakistan Army, if allowed to carry out the campaign fully, they are now in a mindset in which they will be wiping out this Al-Qaeda Pakistan Taliban network. But the real way to defeat the British is basically is that you have to integrate the people. You cannot maintain conflict. Conflicts where the British move in. Once you have a conflict even within the country, like that exists today, because between Pakistan's tribal areas, Baloch, and the Pakistani Punjabis and Sindhis and etc., etc., as long as those things are not integrated together through developmental policy, a long-term policy of development, this will definitely, you know, create the crisis. At the same time, you know, it is also very important for the leaders of these major nations like China, India, Russia, and Pakistan as well to recognize that by resolving this conflict, they will be able to open up the entire Eurasian landmass for the development to the people which they serve, who they serve. It is not, you know, they are not leaders by themselves. They are leaders because people made them leaders, and people, and they are supposed to serve them. By maintaining this conflict, they are depriving the people of the benefits they could get if India, Pakistan, India, China, there's a huge rail networks, there are huge infrastructural development, water is coming from here, going there, power is coming from here, going there. If this entire infrastructure development, which is quite possible and quite, you know, all it needs is that you have to defeat the British by overcoming this conflict and take a mental, develop a mental mindset that we are, everybody benefits out of integration process, and everybody suffers because of the conflicts. So why hold on to this British empire building method? We are not building any empire anymore. We are trying to serve our people the very best way. I mean, we have enough problems to begin with. And so I think that that's what is necessary for the leaders to understand. This is what Mr. LaRouche is saying for years and years.
Right. Let me just add that to put in the right plug before the hour's finished, that Mr. LaRouche's paper, General McChrystal's Folly, is, of course, it's published by LaRouche, LaRouchePub.com, where you're listening. But go to LaRouchePac.com, LaRouchePac.com. Find that there, General McChrystal's Folly, and also activate, contribute, distribute, and put resources to this, because as Jeff and Tana were saying, this isn't a given that it's hopeless, and the British, they have succeeded so enormously that, but as Mr. LaRouche even raises in that paper, they're not smarter than Lucifer, he's not smart either. I mean, they're the devil, and they're not that bright.
Sorry for interrupting you, but from time to time, there had emerged South Asia political leaders who are moving in the direction of resolving the conflict. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, he was killed. Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, Bangladesh, assassinated. Rajiv Gandhi, Indira Gandhi in India were assassinated. So these leaders were trying to outmaneuver the Brits by abandoning that conflict generation game and trying to integrate things. Not that they have succeeded enormously, but long before they could, they were removed. So that is always a threat.
Right. And we have, I understand, Jeff, Mr. LaRouche was excited about the prospect of a new agreements coming together between China and Russia for the development of East Eurasia.
There seem to have been some pretty important new dimensions to economic cooperation that came out of Prime Minister Putin's just concluded trip to, he was in Vladivostok, then he was in Beijing, and they signed quite a number of economic deals. But I think that the character of them is different. It's not just simply raw material extraction, energy, precious metals from Russia on long-term contract. My understanding is that they're now looking at joint investments and development of the technological and infrastructure needs of Russia, including high-speed rail. And as we know, the development of the natural resources of the far northeast of Asia, of the Russian far northeast, is a tremendous challenge, and it's going to take real scientific and technological breakthroughs to achieve it. The Russians at the Vernadsky Institute have done probably the most advanced work on this. So hopefully what we're looking at is Russia-China cooperation on a new era of the kind of international economic cooperation that destroys the British Empire. This is the heart of what Lyndon LaRouche talks about when he talks about the need for the Four Powers Agreement. So if we've got a lot of work to do on the U.S. front with the Obama administration, but this Russia-China development, it's very new. We're still tentatively evaluating it, but it looks to be strategically significant.
And, of course, what we're talking about is the great potential of mass upsurge in the United States of revulsion against the kinds of policies Tanu was just talking about, where you degrade and depress everyone and get them to play against each other. We have a chance to force the issue of the right, the sane side of what we can have coming out of Washington. We only have a couple minutes, but I have an email I'm going to give to Tanu after the show is over, but I'm going to ask him right now. Adam has sent in, Tanu, to ask you about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, which you raised, and bringing indigenous movements within the leadership of the Taliban insurgents. Is that characterized of one of the modes of the British?
This is, you know, there's always the interlinking between Saudis and the British, because Saudis are interested to become the number one in the Islamic world. Saudi Arabia is where the two holiest places of Islam, Mecca and Medina, are situated. And they have enough money because of oil, and they have the British support, and they want to undermine Iran, which is a Shia nation. So to develop this Taliban movement, this indigenous movement within Afghanistan, was the idea of the British, funded by the Saudis, executed by the Pakistanis. That's the way it really happened, the Taliban movement.
Right. Well, in our final, we have 1 minute. I guess that's all. Let me take you back to this part of the world you've paid so much attention to about potential economic development, agriculture development. Also, you've written recently about crazy forms of world free trade that the U.S. Agency for International Development went in and did. Mm-hmm. Do you want to raise that as the example of what we're going to abandon when we... Those commercial plantations for exporting strawberries to Dubai.
Exactly. I mean, when the U.S. went into Afghanistan, I mean, there is always this basic idea of United States is always there that we must substitute opium with something good. But when something good is to be done, then now we make the mistake of handing over to the private investor who is looking at is how to maximize its profit. So they saw a plot of land where huge plot of land in northern Afghanistan, about 150 hectares of land, that's 320 acre of land, where they will have strawberries and things like that. And the other conditions, soil conditions and everything were fine. But one of the mistakes that they made, and they abandoned it quickly, and then it was picked up by USAID and give them some money. But mistake that they made is that it never rains. So the groundwater, the water that they were pouring in to keep the strawberry alive, was just going down the ground in a faster than they could put in. So it turned out to be a total disaster. But the most of the money was funded by USAID. So the U.S. taxpayers took the loss, and nothing good came out of it.
So I only end on the physical economic note of we've had some terrible failures and terrible evil committed against these nations, but we can reverse it. I think that's the message.
Absolutely.
Very
and
definitely.
That's the detail that's just been, and this is the opportunity we have now. So we conclude on that note that
yes.
We could make this the end phase of these failures and evil. And this has been the October 17th, 2009 LaRouche Show, and I thank Tanu Maitra and Jeff Steinberg and ask you to listen again next week, October 24th. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you.
Thanks.